As they approached the main doors of Derry Home, Ralph leaned toward Lois's ear and murmured, "Is it happening to you?" "Yes." Her eyes were very wide. "God, yes, it's strong this time, isn't it?" As they broke the electric eye beam and the doors to the hospital lobby swung open before them, the surface of the world suddenly peeled back, disclosing another world, one that simmered with unseen colors and shifted with unseen shapes. Overhead, on the wall-to-wall mural, depicting Derry as it had been during its halcyon lumbering days at the turn of the century, dark brown arrow shapes chased each other, growing closer and closer together until they touched. When that happened, they flashed a momentary dark green and changed direction. A bright silver funnel that looked like either a waterspout or a toy cyclone was descending the curved staircase which led up to the second floor meeting rooms, cafeteria, and auditorium. Its wide top end nodded back and forth as it moved from step to step, and to Ralph it felt distinctly friendly, like an anthropomorphic character in a Disney cartoon. As Ralph watched, two men with briefcases hurried up the stairs, and one of them passed directly through the silver funnel. He never paused in what he was saying to his companion, but when he emerged on the other side, Ralph saw he was absently using his free hand to smooth back his hair, although not a strand was out of place. The funnel reached the bottom of the stairs, raced around the center of the lobby in a tight, exuberant figure eight, and then popped out of existence, leaving only a faint, rosy mist behind. This quickly dissipated. Lois dug her elbow into Ralph's side, started to point toward an area beyond the central information booth, realized there were people all around them, and settled for lifting her chin in that direction instead. Earlier, Ralph had seen a shape in the sky which had looked like a prehistoric bird. Now he saw something which looked like a long, translucent snake. It was essing its way across the ceiling above a sign which read, "Please wait here for blood testing." "Is it alive?" Lois whispered with some alarm. Ralph looked more closely and realized the thing had no head, no discernible tail either. It was all body. He supposed it was alive. He had an idea all the auras were alive in some fashion. But he didn't think it was really a snake, and he doubted that it was dangerous, at least to the likes of them. "Don't sweat the small stuff, sweetheart," he whispered back to her as they joined the short line at Central Information. And as he said it, the snake thing seemed to melt into the ceiling and disappear. Ralph didn't know how important such things as the bird and the cyclone were in the secret world scheme of things, but he was positive that people were still the main show. The lobby of Derry Home Hospital was like a gorgeous 4th of July fireworks display, a display in which the parts of the Roman candles and Chinese fountains were being played by human beings. Lois hooked a finger into his collar to make him bend his head toward her. "You'll have to do the talking, Ralph," she said in a strengthless, amazed little voice. "I'm having all I can do not to wee in my pants." The man ahead of them left the booth, and Ralph stepped forward. As he did, a clear, sweetly nostalgic memory of Jimmy V surfaced in his mind. They'd been on the road someplace in Rhode Island, Kingston maybe, and had decided on the spur of the moment that they wanted to attend the tent revival going on in a nearby hayfield. They'd both been drunk as fleas in a gin bottle, of course. A pair of well-scrubbed young ladies had been standing outside the turned-back flaps of the tent, handing out tracts. And as he and Jimmy neared them, they began to admonish each other in aromatic whispers, "To act sober, damn it, to just act sober." Had they gotten in that day, or... "Help you?" the woman in the central information booth asked, her tone saying she was doing Ralph a real favor just by speaking to him. He looked through the glass at her and saw a woman buried inside a troubled orange aura that looked like a burning bramble bush. "Here's a lady who loves the fine print and stands on all the ceremony she can," he thought. And on the heels of that, Ralph remembered that the two young women flanking the entrance to the tent had gotten one whiff of him and Jimmy V and turned them politely but firmly away. They had ended up spending the evening in a Central Falls juke joint, as he recalled, and had probably been lucky not to get rolled when they staggered out after last call. "Sir?" the woman in the glass booth asked impatiently. "Can I help you?" Ralph came back to the present with a thud he could almost feel. "Yes, ma'am. My wife and I would like to visit Jimmy Vandermeer on the third floor if..." "That's ICU," she snapped. "Can't go up to ICU without a special pass." Orange hooks began to poke their way out of the glow around her head, and her aura began to look like barbed wire strung across some ghostly no-man's land. "I know," Ralph said, more humbly than ever. "But my friend Lafayette Chapin, he said..." "Gosh," the woman in the booth interrupted. "It's wonderful, the way everyone's got a friend. Really wonderful." She rolled a satiric eye toward the ceiling. "Faye said Jimmy could have visitors, though. You see, he has cancer, and he's not expected to live much..." "Well, I'll check the files," the woman in the booth said with a grudging air of one who knows she is being sent upon a fool's errand. "But the computer is very slow tonight, so it's going to take a while. Give me your name, then you and your wife go sit over there. I'll page you as soon as..." Ralph decided that he had eaten enough humble pie in front of this bureaucratic guard dog. It wasn't as if he wanted an exit visa from Albania, after all. Just a goddamn ICU pass would do. There was a slot in the base of the glass booth. Ralph reached through it and grasped the woman's wrist before she could pull it away. There was a sensation, painless but very clear, of those orange hooks passing directly through his flesh without finding anything to catch on. Ralph squeezed gently and felt a small burst of force, something that would have been no bigger than a pellet if it had been seen, pass from him to the woman. Suddenly the officious orange aura around her left arm and side turned the faded turquoise of Ralph's aura. She gasped and jerked forward on her chair as if someone had just dumped a paper cup filled with ice cubes down the back of her uniform. "Never mind the computer. Just give me a couple of passes, please. Right away." "Yes, sir," she said at once, and Ralph let go of her wrist so she could reach beneath her desk. The turquoise glow around her arm was turning orange again, the change in color creeping down from her shoulder toward her wrist. "But I could have turned her all blue," Ralph thought, "taken her over, run her around the room like a wind-up toy." He suddenly remembered Ed quoting Matthew's gospel. "Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked, was exceeding wroth." And a mixture of fright and shame filled him. Thoughts of vampirism recurred as well, and a snatch from a famous old pogo comic strip. "We have met the enemy, and he is us." Yes, he could probably do almost anything he wanted with his orange-haloed grump. His batteries were fully charged. The only problem was that the juice in those batteries, and in Lois's as well, were stolen goods. When the information lady's hand emerged from beneath the desk, it was holding two laminated pink badges marked Intensive Care Visitor. "Here you are, sir," she said in a courteous voice, utterly unlike the tone in which she had first addressed him. "Enjoy your visit, and thank you for waiting." "Thank you," Ralph said. He took the badges and grasped Lois's hand. "Come on, dear. We ought to..." "Ralph, what did you do to her?" "Nothing, I guess. I think she's all right. Get upstairs and make our visit before it gets too late." Lois glanced back at the woman in the information booth. She was dealing with her next customer, but slowly, as if she had just been granted some moderately amazing revelation and had to think it over. The blue glow was now visible only at the very tips of her fingers, and as Lois watched, that disappeared as well. Lois looked up at Ralph again and smiled. "Yes, she is all right, so stop beating up on yourself." Was that what I was doing? I think so, yes. "We're talking that way again, Ralph." "I know. Ralph?" "Yes." "This is all pretty wonderful, isn't it?" "Yes." Ralph tried to hide the rest of what he was thinking from her, that when the price for something which felt this wonderful came due, they were apt to discover it was very high. "Stop staring at that baby, Ralph. You're making its mother nervous. Ralph glanced at the woman in whose arms the baby slept and saw that Lois was right. But it was hard not to look. The baby, no more than 3 months old, lay within a capsule of violently shifting yellow-gray aura. This powerful but disquieting thunderlight circled a tiny body with the idiot speed of the atmosphere surrounding a gas giant. Jupiter, say, or Saturn. Jesus, Lois. That's brain damage, isn't it? Yes, the woman says there was a car accident. Says? Have you been talking to her? No, it's... I don't understand. Join the club. The oversized hospital elevator labored slowly upward. Those inside, the lame, the halt, the guilty few in good health, didn't speak but either turned their eyes up to the floor indicator over the doors or down to inspect their own shoes. The only exception to this was the woman with the thunderstruck baby. She was watching Ralph with distrust and alarm, as if she expected him to leap forward at any moment and try to rip her infant from her arms. It's not just that I was looking, Ralph thought. At least I don't think so. She felt me thinking about her baby, felt me, sensed me, heard me. Some damn thing anyway. The elevator stopped on the second floor, and the doors wheezed open. The woman with the baby turned to Ralph. The infant shifted slightly as she did, and Ralph got a look at the crown of its head. There was a deep crease in the tiny skull. A red scar ran the length of it. To Ralph it looked like a rill of tainted water standing at the bottom of a ditch. The ugly and confused yellow-gray aura which surrounded the baby was emerging from this scar like steam from a crack in the earth. The baby's balloon string was the same color as its aura, and it was unlike any other balloon string Ralph had seen so far. Not unhealthy in appearance, but short, ugly, and no more than a stub. "Didn't your mother ever teach you any manners?" the baby's mother asked Ralph. And what cut him wasn't so much the admonition as the way she made it. He had scared her badly. "Madam, I assure you..." "Yeah, go on and assure my Fanny," she said, and stepped out of the car. The elevator door started to slide closed. Ralph glanced at Lois, and the two of them exchanged a moment of brief but total understanding. Lois shook a finger at the doors as if scolding them, and a gray mesh-like substance fanned out from its tip. The doors struck this and then slid back into their slots, as they were programmed to do upon encountering any barrier to their progress. "Madam," the woman stopped and turned around, clearly confused. She shot suspicious glances about her, trying to identify who had spoken. Her aura was a dark, buttery yellow, with faint tints of orange spoking out from its inner edges. Ralph fixed her eyes with his. "I'm sorry if I offended you. This is all very new to my friend and me. We're like children at a formal dinner. I apologize." He didn't know just what she was trying to communicate. It was like watching someone talk inside a soundproof booth. But he sensed relief and deep unease. The sort of unease people feel when they think they may have been observed doing something they shouldn't. Her doubtful eyes remained on his face a moment or two longer. Then she turned and began to walk rapidly down the corridor in the direction of a sign reading, "Neurological Survey." The gray mesh Lois had cast at the door was thinning, and when the doors tried to close again, they cut neatly through it. The car continued its slow upward journey. Ralph, I think I know what happened to that baby. She reached toward his face with her right hand and slipped it between his nose and mouth with her palm down. She pressed the pad of her thumb lightly against one of his cheekbones and the pad of her index finger lightly against the other. It was done so quickly and confidently that no one else in the elevator noticed. If one of the three other riders had noticed, he or she would have seen something that looked like a neatness-minded wife smoothing away a blot of skin lotion or a dollop of leftover shaving cream. Ralph felt as if someone had pulled a high-voltage switch inside his brain, one that turned on whole banks of blazing stadium lights. In their raw, momentary glow, he saw a terrible image. Hands clad in a violent, brownish-purple aura reaching into a crib and snatching up the baby they had just seen. He was shaken back and forth, head snapping and rolling on the thin stalk of neck like the head of a Raggedy Andy doll. And thrown! The lights in his head went black then, and Ralph let out a harsh, shuddery sigh of relief. He thought of the pro-life protesters he'd seen on the evening news just last night. Men and women waving signs with Susan Day's picture and wanted for murder on them. Men and women in grim reaper robes. Men and women carrying a banner which read, "Life, what a beautiful choice." He wondered if the thunderstruck baby might have a differing opinion on that last one. He met Lois's amazed, agonized eyes with his own and groped out to take her hands. "Father did it right? Threw the kid against the wall." "Yes, the baby wouldn't stop crying. And she knows, but she hasn't told anyone." "No, but she might, Ralph. She's thinking about it."
"She might also wait until he does it again, and next time he might finish the job."
A terrible thought occurred to Ralph then. It shot across his mind like a meteor scratching momentary fire across a midnight summer sky. It might be better if he did finish the job. The thunderstruck baby's balloon string had only been a stump, but it had been a healthy stump. The child might live for years, not knowing who he was or where he was, let alone why he was, watching people come and go like trees in the mist. Lois was standing with her shoulders slumped, looking at the floor of the elevator car and radiating a sadness that squeezed Ralph's heart. He reached out, put a finger under her chin, and watched a delicate blue rose spin itself out of the place where his aura touched hers. He tilted her head up and was not surprised to see tears in her eyes. "Do you still think it's all pretty wonderful, Lois?" he asked softly. And to this he received no answer, either with his ears or in his mind. They were the only two to get out on the third floor, where the silence was as thick as the dust under library shelves. A pair of nurses stood halfway up the hall, clipboards held to white-clad bosoms, talking in low whispers. Anyone else standing by the elevators might have looked at them and surmised a conversation dealing with life, death, and heroic measures. Ralph and Lois, however, took one look at their overlapping auras and knew that the subject currently under discussion was where to go for a drink when their shift ended. Ralph saw this, and at the same time he didn't. The way a deeply preoccupied man sees and obeys traffic signals without really seeing them. Most of his mind was occupied with a deadly sense of déjà vu, which had washed over him the moment he and Lois stepped out of the elevator and into this world where the faint squeak of the nurse's shoes on the linoleum sounded almost exactly like the faint beep of the life support equipment. "Even-numbered rooms on your left, odd-numbered rooms on your right," he thought. "And 317, where Carolyn died, is up by the nurse's station." It was 317, all right, I remember. Now that I'm here, I remember everything. How someone was always sticking her chart in the little pocket on the back of the door, upside down. How the light from the window fell across the bed in a kind of crooked rectangle on sunny days. How you could sit in the visitor's chair and look out at the desk nurse, whose job it is to monitor vital signs, incoming telephone calls, and outgoing pizza orders. The same, all the same. It was early March again, the gloomy end of a leaden, overcast day, sleet beginning to spick-spack off the one window of room 317. And he'd been sitting in the visitor's chair with an unopened copy of Shira's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich in his lap since early morning. Sitting there, not wanting to get up even long enough to use the bathroom because the death watch had almost run down by then. Each tick was a lurch, and the gap between each tick and the next was a lifetime. His longtime companion had a train to catch, and he wanted to be on the platform to see her off. There would only be one chance to do it right. It was very easy to hear the sleet as it picked up speed and velocity, because the life support equipment had been turned off. Ralph had given up during the last week of February.
It had taken Carolyn, who had never given up in her life, a little longer to get the message. And what exactly was that message? Why, that in a hard-fought 10-round match pitting Carolyn Roberts against cancer, the winner was cancer, that all-time heavyweight champion by a TKO. He had sat in the visitor's chair, watching and waiting, as her respiration grew more and more pronounced. The long, sighing exhale, the flat, moveless chest, the growing certainty that the last breath had indeed been the last breath, that the watch had run down, the train arrived in the station to take on its single passenger. And then another huge, unconscious gasp would come as she tore the next lungful out of the unfriendly air, no longer breathing in any normal sense, but only lunging reflexively along from one gasp to the next, like a drunk lurching down a long, dark corridor in a cheap hotel. Spickle, spickle, spackle, spackle. The sleet had gone on rapping invisible fingernails against the window as the dirty March day drew down to dirty March dark, and Carolyn went on fighting the last half of her last round. By then she had been running completely on autopilot, of course. The brain which had once existed within that finely made skull was gone. It had been replaced by a mutant, a stupid gray-black delinquent that could not think or feel but only eat and eat and eat until it had gorged itself to death. Spickle, spickle, spackle, spackle. And he had seen that the T-shaped breathing apparatus in her nose had come askew. He waited for her to tear one of her awful labored breaths out of the air, and then as she exhaled, he had leaned forward and replaced the small plastic nose piece. He had gotten a little mucus on his fingers, he remembered, and had wiped it off on a tissue from the box on the bedside table. He had sat back, waiting for the next breath, wanting to make sure the nose piece didn't come askew again. But there wasn't any next breath, and he realized that the ticking sound he had heard coming from everywhere since the previous summer seemed to have stopped. He remembered waiting as the minutes passed. One, then three, then six. Unable to believe that all the good years and good times, not to mention the few bad ones, had ended in this flat and toneless fashion. Her radio, tuned to the local easy-listening station, was playing softly in the corner, and he listened to Simon and Garfunkel sing Scarborough Fair. They sang it all the way to the end. Wayne Newton came on next and began to sing Donkershane. He sang it all the way to the end. The weather report came next, but before the disc jockey could finish telling about how the weather was going to be on Ralph Roberts' first full day as a widower, all that stuff about clearing and colder and winds shifting around to the northeast, Ralph finally got it through his head. The watch had stopped ticking. The train had come. The boxing match was over. All the metaphors had fallen down, leaving only the woman in the room, silent at last. Ralph began to cry. Still crying, he had blundered over into the corner and turned off the radio. He remembered the summer they had taken a finger paint class, and the night they had ended up finger-painting each other's naked bodies. This memory made him cry harder. He went to the window and leaned his head against the cold glass and cried. In that first terrible minute of understanding, he had wanted only one thing, to be dead himself. A nurse heard him crying and came in. She tried to take Carolyn's pulse. Ralph told her to stop being a goddamn fool. She came over to Ralph, and for a moment he thought she was going to try to take his pulse. Instead, she had put her arms around him. She... Ralph? Ralph, are you all right? He looked around at Lois, started to say he was fine, and then remembered there was precious little he could hide from her while they were in this state. Feeling sad. Too many memories in here. Not good ones. I understand, but look down, Ralph. Look on the floor. He did, and his eyes widened. The floor was covered with an overlay of multicolored tracks, some fresh, most fading to invisibility. Two sets stood out clearly from the rest, as brilliant as diamonds in a litter of paste imitations. They were a deep green gold in which a few tiny reddish flecks still swam.
Do they belong to the ones we're looking for, Ralph?
Yes, the docks are here. Ralph took Lois's hand, it felt very cold, and began to lead her slowly up the hall. They hadn't gone far when something very strange and rather frightening happened. For a moment, the world bled white in front of them. The doors to the rooms ranged along the hall, barely visible in this bright white haze, expanded to the size of warehouse loading bays. The corridor itself seemed to simultaneously elongate and grow taller. Ralph felt the bottom go out of his stomach, the way it often had back when he was a teenager and a frequent customer on the Dust Devil roller coaster at Old Orchard Beach. He heard Lois moan, and she squeezed his hand with panicky tightness. The whiteout lasted only a second, and when the colors swarmed back into the world, they were brighter and crisper than they had been a moment before. Normal perspective returned, but objects looked thicker somehow. The auras were still there, but they appeared both thinner and paler, pastel coronas instead of spray-painted primary colors. At the same time, Ralph realized he could see every crack and pore in the sheet-rocked wall to his left. And then he realized he could see the pipes, wires, and insulation behind the walls if he wanted to. All he had to do was look. Oh, my God, he thought. Is this really happening? Can this really be happening? Sounds were everywhere. Hushed bells. A toilet being flushed. Muted laughter. Sounds a person normally took for granted as part of everyday life, but not now. Not here. Like the visible reality of things, the sounds seemed to have an extraordinarily sensuous texture, like thin overlapping scallops of silk and steel. Nor were all the sounds ordinary. There were a great many exotic ones weaving their way through the mix. He heard a fly buzzing deep in a heating duct, the fine-grained sandpaper sound of a nurse adjusting her pantyhose in the staff bathroom, beating hearts, circulating blood, the soft tidal flow of respiration. Each sound was perfect on its own. Fitted into the others, they made a beautiful and complicated auditory ballet, a hidden swan lake of gurgling stomachs, humming power outlets, hurricane hair dryers, whispering wheels on hospital gurneys. Ralph could hear a TV at the end of the hall beyond the nurse's station. It was coming from room 340, where Mr. Thomas Wren, a kidney patient, was watching Kirk Douglas and Lana Turner in The Bad and the Beautiful. "If you team up with me, baby, we'll turn this town on its ear," Kirk was saying. And Ralph knew from the aura which surrounded the words that Mr. Douglas had been suffering a toothache on the day that particular scene was filmed. Nor was that all. He knew he could go higher, deeper, wider, if he wanted. Ralph most definitely did not want. This was the Forest of Arden, and a man could get lost in its thickets, or eaten by tigers.
Jesus, it's another level. It must be, Lois. A whole other level.
I know. Are you okay with this?
I think I am, Ralph. Are you?
I guess so, for now. But if the bottom drops out again, I don't know. Come on. But before they could begin following the green-gold tracks again, Bill McGovern and a man Ralph didn't know came out of room 313. They were in deep conversation. Lois turned a horror-struck face toward Ralph.
Oh, no. Oh, God, no. Do you see, Ralph? Do you see?
Ralph gripped her hand more tightly. He saw all right. McGovern's friend was surrounded by a plum-colored aura. It didn't look especially healthy, but Ralph didn't think the man was seriously ill either. It was just a lot of chronic stuff like rheumatism and kidney gravel. A balloon string of the same mottled purple shade rose from the top of the man's aura, wavering hesitantly back and forth like a diver's air hose in a mild current. McGovern's aura, however, was totally black. The stump of what had once been a balloon string jutted stiffly up from it. The thunderstruck baby's balloon string had been short but healthy. What they were looking at now was the decaying remnant of a crude amputation. Ralph had a momentary image, so strong it was almost a hallucination, of McGovern's eyes first bulging and then popping out of their sockets, knocked loose by a flood of black bugs. He had to close his own eyes for a moment to keep from screaming. And when he opened them again, Lois was no longer at his side.
Thank you.